and welcome back to Extra Features Interview. Today we have a short film, a kind of strange short film that somebody's going to have to explain to me what is going on, because it's never answered. Recursion Theorem, we have Dan Franco and Ben Sledge. And guys, what is going on here? You guys are confusing me. That's it? You're not going to give me anything?
I guess I got to start on that one. And, you know, I will say it's meant to be sort of open-ended and a little bit ambiguous, because I really like stories that don't wrap everything up in a neat package at the end and just tell you exactly what's going on. So we try to plant some clues in here and there, and then really to let the audience participate in the story by bringing in their own interpretations. And what I found enjoying with the film is when we show it to different people, like, we get these different ideas that come back. And, you know, some people are like, well, I think, you know, this is what's going on. And then someone else will have a completely different interpretation. And I certainly have ideas in my mind and some seeds that I try to plant in there. But I don't want it to be like, this is my story that I am telling you every little thing and you have to accept it. I think art is an interactive medium, whether it's a painting or a show or a game, and part of it is asking the audience to be involved and to bring their interpretations. That's the answer I'm going to go with for now, and then maybe I can leak out a little bit more as we talk. But to extend on that, I think Dan, you know, has some interpretations of it as well that are always interesting to hear.
Dan?
Yeah, it's you know, it's. From a performing standpoint, it was this great kind of blank slate. You know, it you don't carry in this immense backstory and prologue coming into it. It just you're right in and I'm figuring it out as both the character and the performer as we're going along, because that's the extent of my knowledge of this universe that Ben's created. So it's it kind of it's all about interpreting what's going on right now, as opposed to carrying a bunch of baggage into it.
Okay. Yeah, and part of, like, what I was going there, just from a thematic perspective, is that, like, in a nutshell, Dan the character represents basically how we all come into this world, where we don't know all the answers and we don't really know why we're here, and all we know is that we form some ideas and some beliefs about the situation around us and what we want to accomplish, and we go through some sort of struggle in this life to meet those goals or to get to that belief. And really, our lives end up being defined not so much by whether we attain our goals, but the fact that we set them and that we struggle towards something. And so really, at the heart, the film is about the necessity of struggle, and it's very much inspired by the myth of Sisyphus, who, you know, is in the eternal life up there pushing the boulder up the hill, and as soon as it gets to the top, it rolls back down and he has to start over again. And that's sort of what Dan is involved in, and really, I think it's a great metaphor for life. And there's a great essay by Camus who he has this conclusion where he says you have to consider Sisyphus happy because he has this task to accomplish and this work to do. And that was a really challenging ideal for me. Like, how could this be happy and meaningful? And then I started to realize, like, yeah, that's really what life is. Like, it's really the fact that we have struggles to pursue and follow and something to experience joy and pain and struggle in that human condition along the way. And that's everything that Dan is doing in the film, basically.
And for the record, the character was named Dan before I came on.
Yeah.
It just isn't like the other project we talked about, Simon, where Ken was named after Ken and Jiggets was named after Jiggets. Like, the character was already named Dan.
Don't you represent the struggle of Camus on the wall when the paintings give that away?
Yeah, there's definitely, like I said, we definitely try to put some hints in there. Like, almost all the little cutaways that you see are very thematically relevant and trying to drive home a little bit of that narrative construct that I started with without, like, just telling you exactly what it's about.
So I read into a bit more. Since you're discussing Camus, I mean, the cutting scene, would that be going back to Camus too?
Definitely this, like, the cutting scene, you know, is I think one of the more overt little plays in the game, but basically the idea there of playing with the world as illusion and, you know, and pain as well is definitely going back to this idea of struggle and sensory. And and combining that together. So there's definitely this question of, is Dan in a constructed reality? Is he in any way in our reality? Is he in an afterlife? And so, yeah, those are all playing together and off of each other.
We're going to ask Dan the same questions. I'm going to ask you. I would say Dan is in his own reality that he's created somehow. Either he's in his mind or he's in purgatory. It's either one or the other. And that's the way I took it. Because he's done something to get there. The pictures on the wall are telling me he's done something. Do you know what I mean? That was my giveaway. Maybe I'm reading into it the wrong way, but that's the way I took it. Dan, how did you read into your character?
And, you know, and that's difficult. And we had a lot of conversations on set to that point, because especially there's certain, even beyond the pictures in the room itself, but there's a very heavy emphasis put on the decanter of scotch or in our case, rancid apple juice. That there's a weight there that it almost feels like this is a punishment for something. Ben kind of didn't want to define it as this is, you're paying for past, for being a drunk, for being abusive, for killing someone in a drunk driving accident. This is his existence. This is where he's never known anything other than this. And technically he doesn't know anything other than this. It's not like he feels like there should be more, that there's something, but he doesn't have that context. I feel like for me, I always took it as, that there is a missing piece and that I, because there's certain points where the different recursions, the different iterations kind of rub together, and that's where the only place where color plays into the movie. And so even if he's not overtly aware of those prior iterations, that they exist somewhere within his psyche. So I don't know that I ever brought in a real world that this guy was aware that there was a real world experience. Or like a life prior to this realm that he ended up in, but there definitely was at some level a cognizance, an awareness of other rounds of this story happening.
Okay, I also you're stating that.
Cut it there for a second.
But we're seeing a cause and effect throughout this film. The drinking, he gets another person. You know what I mean? He throws a shoe, he catches it. He climbs up a ladder. He falls. Like, there's constant cause and effect. So I would argue he had to have done something.
Yeah, and Simon is actually hitting something in here where, like, the drinking portion of the film here, like, going back to the alcohol, it was intentionally put in as the only thing that sort of hints and ties to something that may have existed before this loop that he's in. So I'm glad that you've picked up on that, because I haven't heard a lot of
really?
People pick up on that and give that feedback. But it's put in there to be just a very subtle clue for the people who need that justification that he's there for a reason. That's exactly what that's in there for. Okay. So it's sort of the only hint of, like, maybe he hasn't been in this loop from the start, that there was a time before, and this relates back to it.
Okay, I'm going to relate back to the beginning of the film, because you give me a purgatory shot of him going to purgatory, of the souls grabbing him, an Atlas struggle. So, I mean, that could be an alcohol struggle, because that's usually what you hear when you read. Did you go into that, Dan, knowing that you had this stuff on the wall, or it wasn't in the script, obviously?
No, the stuff on the wall was definitely there, that room, when you're working as one person, that room was a character. They did an awesome job of creating this room that it's the only thing other than a version of myself that I get to play off of. And I think I've mentioned, during onset, between takes, I tried to stay as much as I could, unless I had to change shirts or run to the bathroom or whatever. I tried to stay in the set as we were moving, so that I kind of kept in that mindset that this little ominous place was the only thing I was aware of. And the painting things, and especially that goat. It just all really it was a creepy little set.
Oh yeah,
especially when we shot, they built this set. They couldn't find, and I'm sure Ben will get into this a little more later. I couldn't find a practical location that gave us the depth of, you know, to put the camera in the front of the room and have enough to see the rest of the room, doors on either side, windows where we needed them.
Right.
So they ended up building it in a small industrial complex in a warehouse. And so when they turned the lights off in the warehouse and this thing was lit, it was like this one little room in a vacuum, you know, it this massive black expanse and this one little brightly lit space. So it definitely felt, and with the art itself, it like definitely pulled this ominous and sinister kind of feel into this little box.
Okay, let's get into the room since you brought it up. I just want to discuss one more prop, the dead bird. I see color in the film. So we keep going back to the alcohol. So, I mean, you must have hit something. That must be the dead bird representing it. Like, I know I'm reading into this, but I have to because you're making me read into it while I'm watching it. Because the dead bird, I hear a weird sound. That's really when music really identify with music at this point.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking car crash. I'm thinking you smacked somebody. You've done something. Like, you can't – like, that is my biggest argument here. Pictures on the wall. You go for the drink. You see a dead bird. It's all linking in my world.
Yeah, and I will say that the dead bird was initially supposed to be a robin, which has some other you know, meaning to it. Yeah, yeah. And we found out in the process of making this film, we learned a lot. But one was how difficult it is to get a dead songbird and how illegal it can be in most circumstances. So we were very limited. We did actually get – that's a real dead bird in the film.
Oh, my God, really? I thought for sure it was a prop.
Yeah, I tried looking at props, and they all just looked really, really terrible, like almost cartoonish. And, yeah, so we ended up getting a dead bird from a medical research company out in California, and one of many bizarre and weird and interesting stories that happened along the way.
Okay. But before we go any further, I have one last question before I forget, before I leave this whole thing of the drinking. is this based on The Shining? Is that where this idea comes from? Like Jack drinking?
No.
Yes?
No, but it's definitely a nod to The Shining.
Because
in that scene.
That's where Jack goes nuts at that point.
Yeah, we
that
definitely talked wondering. About that on set. And I know Dan had some concerns about it. Like, we didn't – I wanted it to be a reference and a quote almost thematically of that scene in The Shining, the bartender scene. And then Dan was concerned that we don't play it too close. And I think we had we got to a good place where we had to trust one another – like to get through that and make our own interpretation without being so close that we're copying it, and then without being too far away from it that we don't have that reference and that callback in there.
I think that works because Dan's playing himself.
Yeah.
If you had come in or you brought another actor in, I would have gone Shining 100%.
Yeah.
So Dan, that brings me to the point. How is working against yourself?
On the last question, that was the audition scene. When I came in and read with Ben, we read that scene with the split, and that's the first thing that I latched onto was that it felt very much like the bartender in Jack Torrance from The Shining. So that kind of informed where I went, and as we started discussing it, Ben and I, we definitely got touched on that there was a Shining feel to it, and I think we both. From right there, from day one, we were both kind of on the same page, and so that sort of was this great idea that we would be coming at this from a very similar perspective. working opposite myself was, you know, obviously, actually it was Ben that did, because he was just the closest to my height on set, so that way the eye lines were correct and things like that. So I was working opposite Ben. And he was reading the reverse of the scene, and you know, it's a very, it's not really that different than working against anyone else, because you know you're obviously not looking across the scene yourself. You're seeing someone on the reverse side of that scene.
It's like working with a bad actor, because I definitely need to be behind the camera.
I think the tricky part was more the second character of that, the bartender or the Danny version versus Mr. Everett, because he's very calm and very and he has to react to the version of me that's just coming off the rails. And so that was, you know, when you have someone reading it, not necessarily at the level that I performed it on the other side, you're kind of having to fill in some of those gaps between where the person's going and where you went when you did that side of the scene.
Yeah, and Dan did an amazing job in that scene because I wanted him to have such a different personality that even without him speaking, like you could just tell visually in his presence and in his body language and his emotion that this was a different character. It was a different persona, and it works immediately in the film when it cuts over. Like, you know, this is immediately it's someone else, even though it's still Dan. And like, hats off to Dan for that. It was just really well done. Really great performance.
Thank you.
Oh, let's go back to the room. How did you design the room? Like, was that just coming out of your head, or as you built it, you added things?
No, it was. So this whole film, like you're talking about all these the props and paintings and
Dan will tell you I do these kind of things.
Was that a lot?
You would have told him. I am very into things, how they're built and what you add to the scenes, and that's just me.
So the whole process of this film was just, you know, me coming into our group of people, even before Dan was involved, and just saying like, you know, this is the story we want to do, which started out as just a small exercise. And I get all these questions. Well, why does there have to be a dead bird in it? You know, why does there have to be this and that? And, so I'm sort of having to do what we're doing here. So like answer, like, why is all this weird stuff in the film? And I'm like, I can't explain my psychology to everyone in detail and figure this out, but trust me, we'll get through this. And then initially for the set, we were thinking we'd film on location. And so we did a lot of scouting and we'd go and we'd take photos. And what we found are local places that we in no way could afford, or we could find places that we could afford, but we'd have to drive out a couple hours and that wouldn't work for production. So, you know, as we're visiting, we're taking photos. I'm looking at these photos after our trips and sort of realizing that, you know, we really only need three walls and that, hey, guys, I think I can build this. I don't have any history in set design. I don't work in construction, but I'm looking at this and I think we can pull this off. And of course, no one buys that. We're like, oh, that's great. We'll keep looking for other places. And so I really had to come back in with a plan of design drawings of like how we could build this and get this done. And I started convincing people. We looked for a space, we found it, and then we decided to do it. And it was just a learning process. And I think filmmaking is like 80% problem solving. So you have a challenge, you got to figure out a way to around it. In our case, without much money, and building a set was the solution for this. And we learned a lot along the way of if we ever build a set again, what to do and what not to do. So there you go. But it was an adventure for sure.
One of the funny things was, so with the furniture, you're dealing with furniture from a very specific, you know, time frame. House of Cards had just gone into production, so they had kind of come through and wiped out all of the antique shops in and around the area. So our production designer was kind of having a rough time finding pieces that House of Cards hadn't already snagged.
Yeah, that's very true. And so, yeah, we had very specific period of pieces we were going for. And then, you know, I had some very specific paintings and props that I wanted in there. And it's just sort of it all came together. And we constructed a lot of the elements ourselves. Like the shutters on the window were an extreme pain. And we had to actually build the shutters that you see in the background. So, yeah, it was a lot of work, a lot of sweat went into it.
Sorry, I have one last question about the room. Dan, you never come forward at the camera ever. Your character went one way, up, down, never came forward. It was my only complaint.
Because in theory, that would be the fourth.
I know.
The fourth wall. I mean, yeah, I guess there would be some set decoration that direction, but
yeah. I mean, he does come through the fourth wall, but yeah, he never comes out.
I know, and I thought that was weird. I want to go back to one last thing, and I apologize as I read my notes. The screen shakes when he picks up the knife. I forgot to ask you about that. So, again, I'm telling you, there's hints in this film. And I forgot, sorry, as I go, because I make notes as I watch, so I apologize. So how long did you guys
I love it.
Sorry, I'm very detailed. I apologize, because I do watch
it. I love it.
How long?
It makes me happy that someone picks up on all the details.
Oh, how at the beginning of the film, I did want to go, Ben, you talk about donating money.
Yeah.
Now, I've never seen that before. I want that stated. Now, did that just was that a planned ahead of time? You're like, I'm broke. I need some money. Was Dan? Okay with this?
Yeah, we did a quick Kickstarter to raise some money for this, but yeah, we ended up. It's a labor of love. So this is a project that we're not going to make money on, but as an experiment, I thought we'd throw it out there and just see if this is a viable means of trying to sustain independent filmmaking, you know, moving forward. So we have a few people here and there, but yeah.
When it went out to festivals and stuff like that, that was added only for the release on our website. Oh. That wasn't a standard part of it.
I don't know. I got to ask.
Yeah, that's just up there on YouTube. So not something that we would release in the film in the festivals, like Dan said, or, you know, any other.
Well, I got to ask, has it worked? Did it work?
I mean, it hasn't worked to a large degree, but, you know, we've probably gotten a few small donations.
I'm glad you got something.
Yeah.
I have one on my page and I get nothing. So I just, it's fine for me.
Well, on YouTube, you know, they've redone their structuring now. So there's really a challenge out there for small channels and small content creators of, you know, how do you monetize it in some way and get something back to help sustain further creation. And that's sort of the challenge of, you know, micro filmmaking world that we're in.
And it's just, I mean, the challenge of finding an audience has always been, you know, obviously we feel like we've got a very good film here and we haven't been able to drive people to it, and people are willing to watch, you know, Vine videos. And like I said, we were talking before the show, like my son watches all these guys that play video games. So he's basically like sitting in someone's basement watching them play a video game. But they won't come and watch something that feels like an episode of the Twilight Zone that's well done. And so it's a little frustrating that you put your heart and soul into a project and it just struggles to, when you know people would like it, if they would just give it the click.
You're a podcaster, right?
Independent filmmaker is, like, filmmaking is probably the thing I enjoy most, but it's really, we're in this unique period where there's more content than ever out there, which is a blessing and a curse because it makes it harder to get your content seen. But at the same time, there's more channels than ever to get your content on. And so, you know, I'm in this weird space of, like, how do we get to that audience and get that content out there? Because, I'd love to make more films, but I can't lose, like, $10,000 every time I make a film. So that's the hard part of independent filmmaking right now.
I guess what I was going to say, I mean, you got Dan here, though, but Dan has a great film called The Night Watchman, which will drive some traffic to here, I would hope. People would look you out. I mean, you've been on Veep. You've done Outsiders. I expected to see you on House of Cards, actually, at some point.
I did do House of Cards, but it was the way they shot it, when I throw my line out, they're on Claire Underwood. So they do that a lot. They like to stay on the principal cast when other folks are talking. So so it was a one and done on that one.
So what did you guys do with the film? You went to the festival way? Did you go out and promote the film in the festival circuit, or what happened there?
Yeah, we were in about 10 to 12 festivals. Some of them, you know, we were in the Pasadena Film Festival, which was a great one. A bunch locally, regionally here in the DC, Baltimore region. I guess we were out for about a year and a half before we kind of closed shop and moved towards an online distribution, through our website. And it did well. Like it did really well at festivals. It won several awards. People liked the film.
We found that it's a hard film to program for festivals because it's a long short. So, you know, a festival basically has to tell. If they accept our film, you know, they're basically telling one or two other short films no, because, you know, short films usually in the range, you know, 5-7 minutes is ideal, and our film is like three of those. So it's very difficult, and we're not long enough to be considered a feature. So we're sort of in this weird in-between category, and that was a lesson for us going forward, and something that we knew going in, but at the same time, you want to make the film for what it needs to be, and not just like, hey, let's squeeze it down to 7 minutes because that's going to be the best thing for us in a festival and kill the story. So
the film won't work.
Yeah.
It will not work.
We did have one festival where it actually screened with The Night Watchman back to back.
Oh, there you go.
In this
perfect.
Great little two hour
double
window.
Dan.
Double that. I have a question for you guys. Would you guys like to see, I know it's hard exposure for short films and micro shorts and all this. I'm surprised Netflix or Amazon hasn't scooped up a pile of these and just threw it on their network. I mean, you guys, I don't mean to be rude, would take a tiny bit of cash just to get the exposure.
Yeah.
I mean, has anybody ever approached anybody about that? Have you ever heard?
I know that, some short films are on Amazon that they do make those available. I have Amazon Prime, and I've never been served a short film as I've been browsing through what's available to watch. Right. But there's a great film, short film called Roller Coaster that we've been in a couple festivals with, and those guys have done a really great job, and that made it onto Amazon. So, but I think that ultimately ends up being, I don't know, Ben can talk more to that than I can, but I don't know if it's a pay to be on there or if it's how you get on their radar for that.
Yeah, I mean, there's some ways that you can get on just doing it yourself, but you don't get into their main slots, so you don't get very much exposure. And then both with Netflix and Amazon, to get on right now to do it the right way, you sort of have to go through a distributor that has a license to work with those. And so that's sort of the catch-22 right now, and it's definitely something that I've thought about. It's just, you know, there is another substantial investment in doing that, and we're trying to figure out, like, with the film, like, when are we at a stage where we can't put more money into it? And those are just, like, tough decisions to make. So we've been trying this self-distribution for a while just to see how that works out, and then it's challenging as well, so.
If we were on Netflix, we'd definitely, I mean, between Dark Mirror and
Black Mirror.
Get Out, and we'd easily be in the other viewers watched, you know, it'd be an easy segue from one of those types of projects to ours.
I guess as I talked to you, I was thinking, you know, you're sitting there and you're watching Get Out, and then they go, oh, you would like this short film, and you guys would like the intermission film? And maybe Netflix should try something like that. I really think that would make more sense. Because to me, I mean, I'm watching Netflix and I'm looking for something else usually. And usually they give me something I would never watch next.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, 26-minute short film, a 7-minute short film, you'd watch it.
Yeah.
And I mean, and I think that's where they need to go. And I mean, I wish, I don't work for Netflix, but I think filmmakers have to push for that more. Or push for friends. And I think that would happen. Because I think streaming platforms for you guys and everybody is the only way you can be seen, and YouTube.
Yeah.
But YouTube now, like I said, like your son, that's all my daughter watches YouTube.
Yeah.
She watches nothing else.
You're right.
So, I mean, being on YouTube is great, but adults like us that aren't really that 30-second program, like a 10-minute thing, we want something more. So I really hope your film and other films do go that way so you can see them.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because we only do, like, there used to be a time, like, when you would go to the theaters and they would show, like, a little movie beforehand, or you only see that now, like, at the animated films. Like, a Pixar film will usually have a short in front of it, and we've gotten away from that, so we have 30, 45 minutes of commercials now before a film starts in the theater. And so I think it makes sense to go to, like you're saying, a Netflix model where maybe we can bring back that pairing of you just watched a feature, or maybe before a feature or after, you know, you have a short film that pairs with it nicely that you can enjoy. And I personally like that model. I think it makes sense. It's sort of like when you have a meal and then you have either the appetizer or the dessert that pairs with it. So
maybe the Sundance Channel or the IDC Film Independent Film Channel needs a platform because they don't have one.
Yeah.
So I could find your films. Because, I mean, I get reached out by a lot of independent filmmakers that Dan knows because they get a hold of me because I'm the only guy that does this and watches them. Because I enjoy films. Like we were talking, I don't watch a lot of TV. I have never seen The Wire, like we were saying. I've never seen Veep. It's not my thing. But I like independent shorts. I do enjoy shorts because of doing this. And I love giving shorts exposure. And that really bugs me. There's no platform for shorts or independent filmmaking because you guys are talented. I mean, how many times I sit through bad Hollywood films? If you read my Twitter, you'll know I really drag on Hollywood films because I'm annoyed that they spent $25 million and can't entertain me. And you guys have spent $20,000 in 26 minutes entertain me. And that's what I like. Like, you guys care. I'm sitting through Red Sparrow this week going, really, guys? This is $40 million, and I'm bored in the first 40 minutes. Like, you haven't entertained me. You know, yeah, you got my money. And then I know today I'm going to see A Wrinkle in Time.
Oh, man.
And because my daughter wants to go. But, I mean, I'm like, am I going to be entertained for this? It's
$30. I'm worried about that.
I'd rather give you guys $5 to entertain me for 26 minutes. Say, thank you. I was entertained. So,
thank you.
I really think you guys, I mean, I need to promote this more. You guys got to push for a streaming service, independent filmmakers. I don't have the money. Maybe Dan has some contacts I don't know about. But get it out there. Get even if it started at your house and get your kid making Minecraft videos. He must know how to do these things. They're on YouTube all day. And start your own streaming service. I think you guys would be good at it. And no, and just get a quarter every time it's watched, and you'd be happy with that.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I don't know. I don't usually rant these. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I guess
it is. It's definitely one of those things, and it's better now than it was. You know, when I first got into acting and doing independent films with the local group. You know, that crew that we talked with last week with the Night Watchmen. We've done a ton of short films through the years, and what it used to be was you go to a couple festivals, and then there wasn't that online.
Yeah.
So basically, the project had 3-4 screenings, and then it went off into the ether. So at least now there is an online life for these things, and hopefully we can figure out somewhere along the way, because there's every town has 100, 200 people with cameras making, you know, short independent movies, and a lot of them are, you go to these festivals, and we always end up in the short film block. And there's amazing short films that are being put out there, and people who are finding their voice, and you know, they're going to be the next people making those big studio films somewhere down the line.
Well, if they get reviewed by me, don't worry, I'll be making fun of them. Okay, Dan, this is something you didn't get to do last show because DeLuca wouldn't shut up. I apologize, but it was great though.
Yeah, we live with that.
And Ben has never heard an interview, I don't think, so it's time for fun questions. You guys are up for it.
All right.
Sure.
Okay, you guys, just one go at a time, and there will be three of them. Ben, your favorite film?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. All right, so I'm going to cheat, but 2001, Citizen Kane, I'm gonna go with those for now. So those are always in sort of my top five.
Very heavy director films. Very directors got his hands on those films.
Yeah, definitely. Kubrick is by far, probably my favorite director of all time. So I gotta have Kubrick in there.
Dan?
It's Braveheart.
Ooh. Another very heavily directed film.
It's just a movie. For whatever reason, that's the one that I always come back to. I mean, I struggle with this whole top 10.
Yeah, I know.
I love so many movies, and there's some that are more, you know, the artsy movies that I love more, and classic movies that I love more. But overall, that's the one I come back to every time when I should think. I love that movie. I love the music. I love the visuals. I love the story. And so. That's the one.
Has it shaped you as an actor at all?
I don't know. I mean, I don't connect much personally with Mel Gibson, but I've always loved his. I think his one thing about him, and because I think he is a very sincere actor. You look at the scenes he does, and now he loves being right here on in close, and you can't do that if you're not sincere, if you're sitting there and just kind of going through the motions, those scenes that it's going to show. So yeah, I guess in a way that, cause that's what I personally strive for a lot, is just, being real, having real sincere moments and finding the truth in everything. Like the movie we were talking about last week, this absurd dancing scene, for me, that it's funny, but it's a funny scene, but for that character, it's not funny at all. They're going to shoot him if he can't prove that he's not a vampire. So he's dancing is the way he has to do that. So that's where I had to come at it from.
Okay, back to Ben. You're going to get question two, but I'm surprised you didn't answer a Hitchcock or anything. I didn't hear like a Vertigo
Psycho. I'm definitely a fan of Hitchcock, but I think, I'm definitely going to go with Kubrick and Wells over Hitchcock.
Question number two. Dan's over. It's Friday night. You guys are having a few pints or maybe wine. I don't know what Dan drinks. What film are you putting on to watch?
Yes. Yes to the above.
What film are you guys watching? It's Friday night. You're chilling out. Nobody's home.
Wait, go ahead.
Ben, waiting for you.
Sheesh. Lately I've been going back to the Lord of the Rings series, so I would probably continue with that.
You can make them sit for 3.5 hours. You guys are going to be totally toasty.
It's going to be, there's going to be some drinks. So I think it'll get more fun, as we go into it. You'll have enough time there to sort of evolve and take advantage of the situation.
Well, you guys don't have time to make a new short film during that one. You should just film it and go from there.
Oh man, I will say I made the mistake of when I watched the second one, I watched the extended edition, and it was like, I don't know, over 4 hours.
Four and a half. I've seen both. Yeah. I've seen all three, regular and an extended, but not in theaters. I didn't watch them in theaters.
I can't imagine the third one's extended cut.
Almost 5. That one 4:45?
It felt like the recursion theorem. Every time I thought it was over, it started again. Exactly right. Fade to black. Movie's over? No, good. We still got 5 more of these.
Dan, same question to you.
These are simple questions, but they're so hard to answer. If we're getting together with friends and it's a Friday night, it's probably something like drinking involved. It's probably something fun. So like an Edgar Wright movie, Shaun of the Dead or Baby Driver.
Hot Fuzz?
That's the one I haven't seen yet.
Oh.
And I get ripped.
Kick them off.
People be like, how could you not have seen that one? I'm going to see it soon, but I love World's End. I love Shaun of the Dead.
Okay, well, before you see Hot Fuzz, just do a quick look and find the cameos, because they're all hidden, so you'll know who they are ahead of time. Those are what you guys need to look for.
Gotcha.
Or watch the film, then look it up and be like, oh my God, that was him? Yeah, they're in there. Okay, the last question I promise is the easiest. Easy, easy question. Ben, what do you buy at the movie theater when you go to the concession stand?
I'm really traditional. I like a big tub of popcorn, and then I usually have a soda with it. So it's nothing exciting, but I really do. I do actually try to always get some popcorn when I go to the film. I feel like that's just tradition. And yeah, you're overpaying, but you're usually that money is going to the theater itself, and that's sort of how they make their living. And so I'll go for it. I know a lot of people try to skip out. It's overpriced, but I try to do that.
Any smuggling of items going in with you?
I'm not big on smuggling, no, but I do enjoy going with people who are smuggling, and I'm happy to participate on their behalf.
Dan, you're an actor. You're sitting at the night watchman. You look over, and you're like, oh, I think I'd better go to the concession stand. I've seen this film 10 times. What do you buy?
I'm definitely popcorn. I don't drink soda anymore, but I will at the theater, because popcorn and water just doesn't really work, and I may on occasion have been known to smuggle some Reese's Pieces and snow caps in.
Okay, what's a snow cap? I apologize. I don't know what that
is. It's a dark chocolate. It's basically a dark chocolate chip with the white, I guess they call them nonpareils.
I'm impressed you know that.
It's the white sugar balls on top of
is this a chocolate bar? Chip.
What's that?
Is this like a chocolate bar, or is it like just straight candy?
No, they're
chocolate like, chips. It's like a bag of chocolate chips.
Sized.
I don't think they have them. I've never seen them. I've never heard of them. But I was just saying that question to you because you have kids. You must be smuggling something in for them. I know that's coming.
Yeah. I have a hard time. I always buy the popcorn and the soda there because I do want to support the theater. But on occasion I'll augment and bring the dollar box of Sour Patch Kids or whatever it might be.
There you go. So tell everybody where they can find this great film.
You can find it on recursiontheorem.com. Just do a search if you can't remember the website. And we're on YouTube as well. So, you know, just do a search on YouTube for the Recursion Theorem and you'll find us.
And give them money. Give them lots of money for their streaming service.
Or at least share it. Just help us spread the word.
Yeah, that would probably be more meaningful to us. We really want eyeballs on the film more than anything else. So please, if you can, check out the film. Give it a thumbs up. Give it a comment. Give it a share. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, guys, for your time. You were fabulous.
Thanks for having us.